We're going to continue our morning presentations, and what we're going to do afterwards, because the three topics are obviously interrelated, we're going to have the three speakers as a panel discussion, so I would encourage your questions to, so if you can hold them for now, and then at the end of the session we will have a more thorough sort of, once all of the presentations have been completed, we'll have a better sense of where we're at, and we can then direct questions specifically at that. The next speaker is Rabbi Glatt, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce him to you. He is a repeat performer. He has been with us right from the start, and really a pleasure to see him back here together with his wife. Rabbi Glatt is an assistant rabbi at Young Israel of Woodmere. He's also the president and CEO of St. Joseph's Hospital at Beth Page, New York. His CV is also too long for me to go into details today. I want to just highlight a few points for you just to give you some sense of the individual that we are dealing with today. He's a professor of clinical medicine at New York Medical College. He's board certified in internal medicine and infectious disease, and he is the author of over 200 papers in peer-reviewed journals. He has also written a book on visiting the sick, which is available in almost every Jewish bookstore. He has been invited to multiple conferences as a scholar in residence. We had the pleasure of having him in Toronto as well, besides our talk here and in our previous conferences. So without further ado, it gives me a great pleasure to introduce Rabbi Glatt to continue the morning talks.
Okay, good morning, everybody. It's always a pleasure to be at this conference. This is one of the best conferences I have the pleasure of attending, and it's in no small measure due to Dr. Lazer Friedman, who really deserves a tremendous shikaya for Rabbi Jay Kelman in putting together this wonderful opportunity for people to learn Torah together. And it's a pleasure to be on the panel with such distinguished co-panelists. And since my time is somewhat limited, I will get right down to my talk. And of course, there are two rabbis who are going for a probah. And each of them wanted this position very desperately. And each was looking for an edge over the other person. So the first rabbi that was going to be tested managed to get the notes from the second rabbi, from his drasha. And he said, I got the perfect answer. I'm going to give the second rav's drasha, and let's see what he's going to do. So he read the notes, prepared, and got up there the day of the probah, and he gave the second rav's drasha. Now they turn to the second rav. It's your turn to come up and speak. So on the spot, the second rav said, that was such a wonderful talk. I'm going to show you my abilities to quickly pick up and learn something. I'm going to repeat his drasha word for word to show you how smart I am. Needless to say, the second rabbi got the job. So my job today is really to repeat, and hopefully not exactly repeat, a lot of the concepts that Dr. Eisenberg spoke about, and try to put into perspective a specific question that I was asked to address, which is genetic testing in adolescence. All of the things that Dr. Eisenberg said certainly are true, and I'll try not to go over too many of them. I might even get past the first slide. So as we've already spoken a little bit about, do medicine and halacha collide? This is a real picture, not even Photoshop. The answer, the short answer is absolutely not. Medicine and halacha cannot collide. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created medicine, and therefore there is nothing in medicine that can be in conflict with halacha. The trick is to figure out where the conflicts potentially are and understand why they're not a conflict. Not necessarily always so well understood is that science is part of the Torah. It's not a separate field that people can go and study when they don't have time to learn Torah, or when they have a head to not to learn Torah. Science is part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Bria, has already been pointed out several times. It is impossible for there to be a conflict between science and Torah. One needs to investigate what on the surface sometimes is a conflict, and to resolve the conflict. Halacha has to be based upon scientific facts. Halacha is not a vacuum. Halacha is not something that a bunch of rabbis got together in a back room and said, this is what we'd like the halacha to be. And therefore, presto, that's the halacha. But in fact, halacha has to comply with the laws of Teva that HaKadosh Baruch Hu set into motion. And there is no such thing as Das Torah in the absence of looking at facts. The Gemara is replete with examples of Chazal saying, let's go see what the facts are, and then we can determine the halacha. And no posek is able to paskin a shayla based upon his pure Das Torah. It has to be with an understanding of the facts. A Navi possibly can go and paskin a shayla without understanding anything, because he's not really paskin a shayla. He's saying what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. He's a conduit from God. But if you're a Talmud Chacham, which in some ways is greater than the Navi the Gemara discusses, then you have to know the facts in order to be able to paskin accurately. Roshach the Shlita has said many a times, you cannot paskin a shayla without knowing the facts. And I don't think there's a posek that would disagree. And if in fact somebody doesn't know the facts, you will invariably paskin incorrectly. And this is true whatever aspect of psak halacha you're talking about. If it's bishul, if it's medicine, if it's business halachas, if it's shalom bayis shayla, you cannot paskin correctly if you don't take into account the halachic facts. And just as one quick example, smoking. There's a famous truth, I believe, in the Chassam Sofer that says smoking is good. Smoking is healthy. Smoking will make you a better person. Doesn't say exactly like that, but that's the bottom line. If you read this Tshuva, and if you say, well, the Chassam Sofer disagrees with all of modern science, and the Chassam Sofer says, go and smoke. So that's ridiculous. Chassam Sofer was not saying that this halacha lo should be seen, that one should smoke. It's based upon the scientific evidence and facts of his time. Smoking was considered something that could be positive. I don't think there's a posek under the sun today that would say that we should follow the Chassam Sofer blindly and say that we should smoke. And in fact, the vast majority of contemporary posek today would certainly say that there is at least being over an aseh, if not directly being over a los aseh. So halacha didn't change. The halacha is exactly the same as it was, but the circumstances change. The famous story that Dr. Eisenberg spoke about from Yeshaya, where he visits Chizkiyahu, and the quote that the Gemara gives there, Bahade Kivshe Derachmono Lomamach, what are you getting involved in God's business? So I'll try to fill in some facts that weren't mentioned yet about this story. The ultimate result was that Chizkiyahu Melech was supposed to die from a disease that nobody else got better from. And he didn't. He lived 15 years. He didn't die from this disease. This information was trumpeted all over the world. This was such an unusual occurrence. And this actually led to the great, nefarious, evil king Nebuchadnezzar trumpeting this news all over the world. And he made a Kiddush Hashem, and he, as a result of that Kiddush Hashem, was Zolcha to be a king and had a son and his grandson a king as well. So publicizing God's greatness was a tremendous zuchus for Nebuchadnezzar and caused a lot of trouble for the Jewish people. And of course, as already mentioned, the Chizkiyahu had a son, Menashe, that came out of this relationship. Chizkiyahu married Yeshaya's daughter. And Yeshaya's daughter and Chizkiyahu had a son, Menashe, the grandson of Chizkiyahu of Yeshaya, who ended up killing Yeshaya. So this was bad news on all accounts for the Jewish people. And the other interesting thing was that there actually was a twin birth. When Menashe was born, he had a twin. Some of the Mepharshim decided the Gemara and Brachos discussed this. He had another son named Rav Shoke, not the Rav Shoke that's mentioned elsewhere in Tanakh, but Chizkiyahu and Yeshaya's daughter gave birth to twins, Rav Shoke and Menashe. And one time, Chizkiyahu was carrying his sons on his shoulders, and one son said to the other, look at this bald head of our father. When is he going to die? When will this melon crack open so that we can become the kings and take over for him? And Chizkiyahu was so shocked and amazed at this chutzpah that he dropped both the sons. Rav Shoke died, Menashe did not. And Menashe went on to become the longest reigning king of Malchus Yehuda for 55 years, and certainly was exactly what Chizkiyahu worried about. So, Bahade Kivshe de Rachmana, Lamaloch. What are you getting involved in God's business? It's not our business to get involved in God's business. At the same time, it's been pointed out, we have a chiyuv to go and explore the world. And many of the psukim already have been discussed. And Rabbi Dr. Stein, we mentioned last night, the famous Rambam in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah. I find it interesting that all of us had no prior knowledge of what the other ones were speaking about, and we're quoting many of the same Rishonim and Mefarshim, because they're so essential and so basic and so important in the field of Jewish medical ethics. And basically, the Rambam said that in order to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be the Hakka, you have to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And one acquires knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu by seeing the world, not by sitting in a base medrash only. Wonderful thing to sit in a base medrash 24 hours a day, but there is something to be said for those of us that make our panasa outside of the base medrash. And one can use that to make a Kiddush Hashem as well. And one can go and see HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every aspect of this world, and especially in science. And therefore, learning science is not just a nice thing to do, it's also a mitzvah if you're using it in the proper way. If you're using it to understand the Kodesh Baruch Hu, that's a hechsher mitzvah, if you wish, of the Ahavta's Kodesh Baruch Hu. So now getting to the subject at hand. Are you allowed to participate in a genetic study? Is a person allowed to enroll in a genetic study? So, in view of what we just spoke about, if you want to go and see what genetic traits are prevalent in the Jewish population and do something with that, or even if you're not going to necessarily do something about this, practically we don't yet have that technology, there is an idea of understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it may be, in fact, something that even if there is no direct therapeutic benefit, just for the increased understanding of the Chochmas Hashem, it would be permissible. Recommended is a different story. But permissible, certainly, and this is specifically stated by our Rav David Bleich, J. David Bleich, in tradition, in an article that I believe is already mentioned as well. So this is a critical point, that knowledge to understand that HaKadosh Baruch Hu in and of itself is a wonderful thing and is a mitzvah, or at least a hechsher mitzvah, an aspect of the Ahavtas HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Is it advisable? Just because something is allowed, does it mean that it is something that we should be doing? So, as has already been mentioned a number of times as well, a person is not allowed to blindly do something that has risk to it and say, I trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu to help me. That's certainly incorrect. It is probably an act of gaiva to say that God's going to go and sort of make a miracle to help me. It's also to daven for such a thing. It is also for a person to go and ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a miracle. And if you're doing something that would necessitate God doing a miracle for you, it is probably an issa that you are doing, and certainly it is an act of gaiva. Therefore, bitachon, saying I'm going to trust in Hashem, is wrong, and that doesn't in any way allow one to not do the things that will make a person healthier. Again, this is also explicitly all stated by Rabbi Bleich. This is a true story. Sarah, a young Jewish woman, dabbed her eyes and held back the tears. Have you ever been in love? Have you ever gazed into another person's eyes and known you finally met your Bashert? She was dating for 5 years. And she finally met the person that she thought was going to be her zivig. And he was the right person for her. They became engaged. And unfortunately, they didn't take advantage of some of the ideas that have already been discussed and I'm going to discuss now in terms of genetic screening. And she was told that she was in fact a Tay-Sachs carrier and her prospective husband was a Tay-Sachs carrier. I was asked a similar shayla last week. A young person came to me and said, did I do the right thing? He went out on his fourth date with a young girl. And that's when they checked their Darius Sharon list. And they found out that they were both positive for one of the genetic diseases on the list. And that they, in fact, would have had a 1 in 4 chance of having a child. And he said he broke up with her. And did he do the right thing? He wanted to ask me a shayla. What should he have done? These are unbelievably difficult shilas. The rub that would have to pass him for this lady, what she should do in this situation, I don't envy being in his shoes. I wasn't very comfortable trying to give some comfort and consolation to this young man when he came to me a week ago with this specific shayla. The Igros Moshe, the famous tshuva that was mentioned, was actually written to his son-in-law, Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi Tendler was one of the proponents of Tesach's testing early on. And Rabbi Moshe wrote this tshuva to his son-in-law, Rabbi Tendler. And he said, the things that have already been mentioned, I put them here again for you to see. While technically you might be able to rely upon Tom Tiyam Hashem Elokecha, and Rashi says, Befavish over there, don't divine the future. Don't go do something like this. Yet Rav Moshe said, get tested. His bottom line recommendation from this troop is get tested. And he says that all the reasons that have already been mentioned, that this should be done in a certain way, in a certain time, which we'll discuss right now. And he says it's a mitzvah to publicize such testing in papers and in other media. Rav Moshe was an Avi. He's talking about the internet. He's talking about tweeting this information and twittering it all over the place. He further says, people aren't always knowledgeable. One of the major problems that I face as a Rav is people giving me misinformation. When they ask me medical shaylos as a Rav, when they ask me other types of questions as a Rav, they don't know the information. They present information to me, and Baruch Hashem, sometimes I know enough to know that they're presenting me wrong information. When I don't know, when they're presenting me wrong information, I'm invariably going to give them the wrong answer. There's a famous story about the Chazon Ish. He was learning. He was famous for Chazon Ish. Was famous for learning by himself. He didn't have a yeshiva that he learned in. And the story goes, this is the way I was told the story. He was learning in Panovich as a young man, and the Rosh Yeshiva at that time was giving a shiur, and the Chazon Ish walked up to him in the middle of the shiur, pulled out a Mishnah from some esoteric place in Kalem or Uktim, I don't remember where the story actually was, put the sefer there in front of the Rosh Yeshiva and walked out of the room. Rosh Yeshiva looked at the sefer, closed all the svarim he had opened, he said, I made a mistake, I'm canceling the rest of the shiur. That's it for today. So they went to the Chazon Ish after and says, you know what happened? He says, you proved the Rebbe wrong. He said, yeah, this time I caught him. What's going to be when I don't catch him all the times? And I don't know when he's telling me the wrong thing. That's the Chazon Ish. We're not the Chazon Ish. But when we get shaylos from people, we get a lot of information that could be wrong. And one has to be very much aware that you're not getting asked questions by the Chazon Ish. You're getting asked questions by normal, wonderful Baal Batim, who may not be scientists, who may not be familiar with all of the things that you might be familiar with. And you have to understand that. And Rav Moshe understood that. And he says there is an irrational stigma. But it's there. And anybody who says that you can get around such stigma and get around such potential misinformation just by educating the people has not been an educator for a long period of time. I can't tell you how many times I've said something in a shiur or in a class or in a lecture and have people come up to me afterwards and absolutely, very honestly and nicely, totally misquote me. Maybe I'm not a very good lecturer, but they may also not be the best listeners. That's normal. That's human beings. So Rav Moshe was very much aware of this irrational stigma. And therefore he says you have to be very careful not to disclose this information to others. A physician is also to disclose this information unless there are very specific parameters met. And Rav Moshe, again, in his great wisdom, said, test people when they're ready because they may not be able to understand and the potential psychological damage could be significant. This is Rav Moshe's opinion. Dor Yesharim essentially follows the advice of Rav Moshe. Dor Yesharim is a wonderful, wonderful organization. It's based upon a pasuk in Tehillim, which talks about setting up a Dor Yesharim. And it's also officially known as the Committee for Prevention of Genetic Diseases, which is a more scientific name than Dor Yesharim, but doesn't encapsulate the concept as well as Dor Yesharim. And they test for these diseases as of today. There are other diseases that they're working on testing as well. The beauty of Dor Yesharim is, I think, the story behind it. I've had the pleasure of knowing Rabbi Eckstein, who is an unbelievable gentleman. This man had four of his first five children die of Tay-Sachs. Rachmana Litzlan, nobody should know the suffering that he's had. He founded Dar Yisharim with the Haskam of Great Gedolah, and none of his additional children since then, I believe, if I'm 100% sure, I think he has 11 children. None of them. I don't think he did PG Day. This is all pre-PG Day. None of his children since then had Tay Sachs. And because of this single individual, which is a tremendous musa to what people can do, when they set their mind to doing something, one individual has essentially eradicated Tay Sachs from the Jewish community. I have friends of mine who were at various hospitals in Brooklyn, and they used to have wards of Tay Sachs children in the hospital. All 100% Nebuch died. There is no recorded case of a Tay Sachs child surviving beyond a few years of life. This isn't the disease that you have a form thrust. This isn't the disease that has some children that somehow make it through, or that we have therapy for in our modern technological advanced society. Every Tay Sachs baby will die at a young age. And this man individually has changed the shape and form of this disease in the Jewish community. Now, is this the only methodology? And the answer is clearly no. And there are really two schools of thought. And basically you have the direct versus the indirect genetic screening approach. The direct essentially deals with one-on-one direct counseling of an individual for specific genetic diseases, with every test being done for that individual, looking at all of the different tests that are available and saying, you are a carrier for this, you're not a carrier for that. And this, again, we're talking about recessive diseases, but it can be done for dominant genes as well. And I'm going to focus right now still on the recessive gene approach. This can be done for very serious diseases, or it has the option of being done for less serious diseases. There are some genetic markers that are available that can test for things that aren't fatal. There is no limit on the number of tests that can be done with this panel. As contrasted with the indirect methodology that Dr. Sharm uses, they only look at certain recessive genes. It's a specific number. The panel, I believe today, has 10 tests that they're looking for. They may have added an 11th one. It only looks at serious, potentially fatal illnesses. This testing is done, if you follow the Dar Yisharim pattern, only in men and women of dating age who are seriously contemplating getting married, but should be done early enough in the dating that when the couple has gone out and think that there's a potential that this could go forward, they should immediately use the Dar Yisharim testing methodology, which is a blinded system, which each will call in a number, and they get back a response, you are compatible, you are not compatible. Neither side knows what carrier states they may have or may not have. All they know is that they're compatible. If the same carrier, if one, for example, had five carrier traits and the other had five carrier traits, but none of them match, so that would be a compatible match. Whereas if one of them only had one, the other had one, but they're the same one, so they would be termed incompatible. There's no stigma attached to this. Nobody knows who, quote, the problem is. And at the same time, you don't have any of the knowledge available to know for future generations what your status is. It obviously needs to be done early enough so that you don't get into the emotional problems that I just described halacha l'maisa to myself a week ago, and the story, the even much more tragic story that I put up there of a woman who had been dating for a while and was ready to get married. As opposed to the direct test, it can be done any time at any age. Partner testing is unnecessary if you use this methodology. If you're not a carrier, then there is no way that you can have a child that will have disease, no matter how many genes the other person is positive for as a carrier. Again, the Dar Yisharim methodology tests compatibility of the partners. Carriers themselves aren't identified. There is a tremendous opportunity to educate the community and people and to, quote, empower them regarding their disease potential states in terms of their transmitting disease to future generations. But there is then that negative potential stigma, as Ramosha says, the nervin, the potential for hurting and harming a person that is not present at all in the indirect methodology. And then there's the question of cost. Dar Yisharim has a relatively low cost to do this panel of testing, much, much less expensive than if you were to go and test these individuals yourselves as a private physician or as a private company, whereas the direct testing methodology has the potential to be picked up sometimes by insurance, but more frequently as an out-of-pocket expense. But again, you may be saving money by not having to test both partners. Neither one is intrinsically better. There are two options, and you really need to know your customer. You need to know the patient to decide which one is more appropriate. I can say that the Dor Yeshara methodology has worked, and certainly in the Haredi communities, that is the preferred testing methodology. In other communities, I think that the Dor Yeshara methodology works wonderfully. It tests for 10 diseases. It tests both partners without attaching any stigma. And it's a wonderful methodology. For those that prefer the more active, directed, educational approach, because in fact, there's nothing wrong with it. Neither one is intrinsically better than the other. Which test is right? It depends. You can't fit a square peg into a round hole. On the other hand, the last part of my talk is talking about dominant gene testing for adolescents. And here you're running into a tremendous number of much more serious concerns. I don't think there's anybody that disagrees with testing of recessive genes for the young couples. At what point is the only disagreement and through what methodology? But everybody agrees that it's a wonderful idea. But when you're testing for dominant genes, as has already also been pointed out, positive results can be unbelievably hazardous because they're obtained decades before the actual disease is present. A negative test, however, does tell the individual who may be unbelievably scarred and worried because their parents or their siblings have died of this disease and they can't go through life not knowing whether they're also going to die that way or not. So there is an aspect both positive and negative to knowing. So what are the benefits over here? So I think here it's a much more difficult, if you wish, risk analysis. I would strongly say that if there is treatment available, then you're dealing with a normal, potentially treatable disease, and why would we want to screen for colon cancer? It's not a genetic test you're screening for, but you're screening for something which, if caught early, can be treated and very well managed. On the other hand, don't do the test if the pre-symptom result is going to be life-changing and there's nothing you can do about it. Why would a person necessarily want to have information that is only negative and that is absolutely nothing that can be done about it? There are tremendous important financial discrimination concerns that New York State, for example, has addressed in law. I'm sure other places in the country and even out of the country have similar laws. If there is something that you can do to prevent the disease, maybe removing certain risk factors or risk behavior, if there are things that you can do to ameliorate the presentation of the disease, delay the onset of the disease, delay the severity of the disease, these are all potential reasons that one would do such testing. One of the most important aspects of Bikur Cholim is to allow the person to put their affairs in order. If this is something that would be a zechus or a positive for the person, that might be something also to be considered. On the other hand, this has tremendous social and marriage implications. Who would want to go into a shidduch with somebody knowing that they're going to be a widow at the age of 30 or 40 or 50? So such a information can be tremendously deleterious to that person's personal life. And one needs to understand that there is a risk of suicide. Never anybody who's a physician has often had to give bad news to their patients. In my field, one of the most dangerous things to do is to tell a patient that they're HIV positive. And unfortunately, there have been reported cases of patients being told that they're HIV positive who have gone out and committed suicide, which is why we have an entire system in place to try to make sure that those patients have a support system from minute one to make sure that such horrible outcomes don't occur. And certainly this is very, very true and very much of a concern when you're telling somebody that they have a fatal disease that they're going to die from much earlier than they would have otherwise expected. So, you're somewhat caught between a rock and a hard place in trying to figure out what to recommend from a halachic point of view to such patients. So I'll give you two examples. Each of them, I think, touches upon most of the things that I talked about. And one is the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, of which there are actually two components, two types, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And as already been mentioned several times, these have a predisposition, but certainly not a vadai, that they will have a person who has such a gene have breast cancer and or have ovarian cancer. Certainly the risk is there. It's a significantly higher risk, but by no means is it a vadai. So in this situation, if the results are going to significantly affect treatment or management, if you're going to get mammograms on a much more regular basis, if you're going to get MRI of the breast. If you're going to do a prophylactic mastectomy, bilateral prophylactic mastectomy, if you're going to do other invasive and or diagnostic treatment modalities, so then one can make the argument that halacha would certainly sanction, if not require, such testing. For BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene testing, I'm not sure if all the information that I just provided is actually there. And whether a person should be halachically required to undergo testing, I think the answer is clearly not. Is it halachically mutter, permissible to undergo such testing? I think the answer is clearly yes. And it really depends upon that person's individual risk factors, the strength of the family history, the other risk factors that are there, and what the patient is willing to do or not willing to do, given the fact that the test will be positive or the test will be negative. There are tremendously important effects, both socially and shidduchim-wise, financially, in terms of job security, in terms of insurance, that New York State law has actually passed various protections for such people who are identified as having such genetic predispositions. And it's actually illegal to discriminate against somebody, but I don't think anybody's ever been sued for not accepting a shidduch. And therefore, this is something that is a very real halachic shayla that an individual needs to be aware of when they decide to ask their rav, do they or do they not want such genetic testing? Bottom line is, there is no simple answer that can be given. A rav, in the background of knowing all of the facts, needs to make a halachic decision for that patient if that's what they're asked. Well, the rav can say, you're allowed to, but I'm not confident to give you further advice. You really need to discuss with your doctor whether this makes sense for you. And on the other hand, you have something like Huntington's chorea, which has been mentioned already, which manifests itself usually in the 30, 40, or 50 age group. It originally is a debilitating disease that becomes ultimately a fatal disease for which there is no treatment, for which there is no preventative therapy. There is nothing that you can do, to my knowledge, I'm not a neurologist, but there is nothing that you can do, to my having looked last week on the internet and all the various sources, see if there's anything new. There is nothing that I'm aware of that you can do to in any way change the course of this natural outcome. And therefore, the halachic shailas that come up is if a person knows he's positive, are you mechuyev to disclose this information? And my understanding would be that from the posting that I saw, you would be mechuyev to disclose such information to a potential shidduch. And if in fact you did not disclose such information to a shidduch, you might have a question if this is a kiddushei tos. And in fact, there will be grounds for the marriage having not taken effect. Now, that's a huge halachic decision, and you need a great posek to individualize and say, yes, that's the case here. But that's the level of shiloh that you're dealing with. To conclude, therefore, I think, as has already been discussed quite a bit, everybody's in agreement that genetic screening for certainly near fatal or fatal recessive traits is a great idea. It should be done well before the people involved are going to consider getting married to each other, if you want to have the maximum benefit. Otherwise, you run into all of the shilas that Rabbi Steinberg talked about last night. It has to be done with the maximal halachic benefit, with the maximal halachic allowance, doing the minimal halachic harm. People will do things wrong if we give them the opportunity to do so, and it's very important that we not be in any way facilitating people doing aveiros. Genetic screening for dominant diseases, as I mentioned, has huge, much more greater halachic shailas. I don't think that you could give a general talk and say this is what should be done, but it must be individualized, and it will depend on the genetic disease that you're talking about. It will depend upon the psychology of the people, the age of the people, the marriage status at the time, and a whole bunch of other factors. And the bottom line is here, more so than with recessive genes, what are we getting involved in something that we really don't have the full understanding of, and what are we getting involved in something that we don't have the ability to do something about it, but other than causing harm and trouble for the person. So I hope I've somewhat answered the question about the specific issues of adolescent screening. These are, again, these are very high and important ideas. But we do have a lot of permission to do something about it, and where we have the ability to do something about it, I think that we have an obligation to try to make life as pleasant for us as well as for our future and real offspring as much as we possibly can. Thank you very much.